The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And if you were looking for separation of church and state today in Washington, D.C., you wouldn't have found it on Capitol Hill. The Roman Catholic Vicar of Christ spoke to the secular U.S. House and Senate, two bodies dedicated to the idea that governments endorse no churches and churches have no role in governments, a nation supposedly suspicious of kings and all leaders wearing strange hats. Yet, with lawmakers sitting at rapt attention, Pope Francis, in a historic speech, spoke of a global partnership of faith and will to confront the problems of the world. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, was there.
Well, I was in the House chamber for the Pope's appearance today. It was a packed house where a beaming speaker, John Boehner, directed the proceedings and really seemed to forget, at least for a while, the deep divisions that threaten his own job right now. It was a strictly limited audience, one guest per member, no former members allowed. But if you scan the room, you saw the cardinals and archbishops from all over the country. Newt Gingrich was across the way. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie sat just a few feet away. And so did presidential candidate Dr. Ben Carson. He was a guest of a South Carolina congressman, he told me. Well, they all heard the Pope deliver a message of peace and the kind of economic critique the world has come to expect from Pope Francis, of capitalism without regard to the poor or the disadvantaged or the environment.
Now is the time for courageous action and strategies aimed at implementing a culture of care and an integrated approach to combating poverty, restoring dignity to the excluded, and at the same time, protecting nature.
Now, the Pope used his American audience to invoke Americans who he said valued freedom, Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King. Representative John Lewis of Georgia was visibly moved when the Pope mentioned Selma, Alabama, and the marches there that Lewis was part of in the civil rights movement. But the Pope may have surprised some people by highlighting Dorothy Day. She was the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, a convert to Catholicism, born in Brooklyn, a staunch, at times radical, advocate for the rights of the poor. Day was a bohemian and a suffragist, a socialist, and a hunger striker.
In these times, when social concerns are so important, I cannot fail to mention the servant of God, Dorothy Day, who founded the Catholic Worker Movement. Her social activism, her passion for justice and for the cause of the oppressed were inspired by the gospel, her faith, at the example of the saints.
Now, it might not surprise you to know that the Vatican has already opened up beatification proceedings for Dorothy Day that are likely to one day soon make her an American saint. But let's be honest, this was a political crowd, after all. Members were asked, told, in some ways, not to applaud in a partisan way like they do for the cameras at the State of the Union. I got to say, that went out the window pretty quickly, though it wasn't nearly as partisan as usual. Now, you didn't hear the word abortion, but you did hear this.
The Golden Rule also reminds us of our responsibility to protect and defend human life at every stage of its development.
You didn't hear the words climate change, but you did hear this.
I call for a courageous and responsible effort to redirect our steps and to avert the most serious effects of the environmental deterioration caused by human activity.
You didn't hear the words immigration reform, but you did hear this.
In recent centuries, millions of people came to this land to pursue the dream of building a future in freedom. We, the people of this continent, are not fearful of foreigners, because most of us were once foreigners.
Now, the Pope called for the abolition of the death penalty directly, drawing one congresswoman right out of her seat. Listen.
This conviction has led me from the beginning of my ministry to advocate at different levels the global abolition of the death penalty.
Now, that yelp you heard there was Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez of New York. She quickly sat back down and seemed a little flustered by her own outburst. But there were audible murmurs in the room. It was quite a moment. Maybe the cameras didn't pick them up. When at the heart of the Pope's economic critique was an attack on profit from the global weapons trade, the arms trade, and the billions in American profit made from it.
Sadly, the answer, as we all know, is simply for money. Money that is drenched in blood, often innocent blood, in the face of the shameful and culpable silence, it is our duty to confront the problem and to stop the arms trade.
After the speech was done, the Pope left the chamber and went to honor a statue of the newest saint, Junipero Serra. He was an 18th century missionary from California, was beatified yesterday at the National Shrine here in Washington. He then appeared with Speaker John Boehner on the speaker's balcony to wave to the tens of thousands gathered on the west front of the Capitol to watch the speech on jumbotrons. The Pope had implored lawmakers to work together, to see each other's humanity, and to solve problems that matter to people.
Today, I would like not only to address you, but through you, the entire people of the United States. Here, together with the representatives, I would like to take this opportunity to dialogue with the many thousands of men and women who strive each day to do a honest day's work.
And then it was goodbyes. Into the famous papal fiat, the Pope went and pulled away from Congress. And then it was back to it. Congress is facing a shutdown next week. The Senate is holding a vote on a spending bill with a defund of Planned Parenthood this afternoon.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent on Capitol Hill. Rachel Donadio, culture correspondent for the New York Times and the paper's former Rome bureau chief, says the Pope claims to value action above ceremony, but manages to generate enormous spectacle wherever he goes, a sign, she says, of his power to lead as an outsider.
I think that compared to Benedict, whose papacy was a little bit more troubled, and who was a more introverted, shy theologian who was never completely at home in his public persona and who didn't really love tangling with contemporary politics and pressing global issues like climate change. Now we have Francis, who comes in and really wants to engage. He really wants the church to be an active force in helping make the world a better place. That's the thing about this Pope. I think he wants change on many different levels, global, political, and also spiritual.
Is he aware of the electricity that he's generated in his way of dealing with the faithful? Is he aware of how he comes across? And are the leaders in the church aware of his very, very different kind of charisma?
I think that his kind of radical humility has really drawn a lot of people towards him, people who might not have been drawn to the church before, Catholics, and also he's really won over the intelligentsia, not that there are 1.2 billion of them, but there are that many Catholics. I think that it's caused a lot of uncertainty for different people in the Catholic world, for different Catholic officials who, inside the Vatican, there's a little bit of disdain for this poverty act that he's doing, but that's maybe a little bit of a, you know, not particularly charitable view. But I think around the world, I mean, the fact is he's just brought so much positive attention towards the church that I think that most people in the Catholic world see that as a positive thing.
Do non-Catholics that you've spoken with get excited about, and even outside of the intelligentsia, get excited about this Pope and his potential to be an agent of change that kind of was an unexpected sort of boon at a time when people are so disillusioned with governmental institutions right now?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can't think of another leader on the planet at the moment who seems to be generating so much enthusiasm as Francis. It's a time when, as you say, people are very disappointed in political leaders. There's a lot of disaffection. There's a sense that things are not particularly in control in certain parts of the world. And here's Francis, who just is saying we want change and you know, wanting to make the world a better place. It's a little bit almost a kind of simple and straightforward message. But yeah, I mean, he has not gotten much bad press, and I think people really are resonate with him, people all around the world, not just Catholics.
Is he having fun, and are the people around him having fun?
You know, I think he's having a lot of fun, and the people around him are too. When I was back at the Vatican in the summer, it just felt like the air had lifted. It was a lighter atmosphere. In the last few years of Benedict's troubled papacy with various scandals, it just felt like things weren't really in control, and it was kind of a depressing moment. I think that he's just, you know, he's in this seat for only a certain amount of time. He's 78 years old, and I think aware of his age, and I think he's going to just try to, you know, drive the car as long as he can and see where it goes.
Rachel Donadio, European culture correspondent for the New York Times. Before that, she was Rome bureau chief for the Times, where she covered the Vatican from 2008 until 2013. We have with us someone who has rolled up his very secular sleeves with the Pope to talk about poverty and other problems facing the world. Dr. Jim Yong Kim, the former Dartmouth president who was called on by President Obama in 2012 to head the World Bank. With me now, Jim Yong Kim, president of the World Bank. Welcome.
Thanks very much, John.
So what is it like to be in the same room with Pope Francis, really rolling up your sleeves to talk concretely about dealing with the world's problems like poverty?
Well, it was a great experience, John. And as we were walking in, his fellow priests were telling us about all the changes. Gold crosses had been replaced with metal crosses. Everyone was living more humbly. And then walking into the room, it was a thrill. I've been working in Latin America for years, so we spoke in Spanish. And I told him directly about our goal at the World Bank of ending extreme poverty and boosting shared prosperity. And we talked about the foundations for that kind of conviction. And it's really embedded in ideas that he helped to create in Latin America decades ago, this notion of a preferential option for the poor. I asked him directly to help us with this movement to end extreme poverty in the world, and he simply answered, "Cuenta conmigo, count on me." And so we have been working closely with not only the Catholic Church but many others to try to end extreme poverty. You know, his great message is you got to focus on the poor, you got to focus on climate, because at the end of the day, the impact of climate change is the worst on the poor. I can tell you of many different countries where they're already beginning to feel the boot of the changes that are brought by more carbon in the air. And he said, you bring those two together because it's our responsibility to our children and to future generations.
You spoke with the Pope in 2013. It's 2015. What progress have you seen? What initiatives have actually taken root? It's fine to talk about the symbolism of taking down gold crosses and the kinds of symbolic gestures that even the World Bank can offer. But what can you do?
Well, you know, I think he's changed the conversation. So now he's such an iconic and beloved figure that talking about the extreme poor, you know, making it cool to think about and really engage the problem of poverty, I think is a change. I mean, on Saturday, we have the Global Citizen Festival, where we have young people and Beyonce and all these great artists talking about a movement to end extreme poverty in the world. That's a difference from a few years ago.
And the cool to solve poverty idea, you know, could be a photo op unless what happens?
Well, so, you know, we've looked back, and if you think about what's happened in the world, you know, just 25 years ago, almost half the people living in developing countries lived in extreme poverty. That's less than $1.25 a day based on $2,005 dollars. And in the last 25 years, more than a billion people have been lifted out of extreme poverty. This is one of the great success stories of all time. Our goal is to get it down to less than 3%, which is about as low as we could probably get it. And it's going to be a big struggle over the next 15 years, but we can do it. So the three things that we found as we look back on our 70 years of history in fighting poverty, economies have to grow, but not in just any way. They have to grow in a way that lifts the poor out of poverty and that benefits the bottom 40% more than the rest of the population. We know now more than ever before that investing in people, health, education, these are not just good things to do, nice things to do. If people are healthier and if people are better educated in the medium and long term, your economy grows more. More jobs are created. And finally, a new thing for the bank, really, one of the things we've discovered is giving cash directly to poor people and then telling them that they should keep their kids in school and keep them healthy. That actually doesn't take away the desire to work. It actually boosts the economy and brings them into the labor market. So economies have to grow, you have to invest in people, and you have to ensure that they don't fall back in poverty. If we do those three things, we can end extreme poverty in the world. And John, we're the first generation in human history that can actually say that we can see the end of extreme poverty.
What are the opportunities for coalition building that didn't exist before? The UN seems to be having some success on some problems, not so much success on conflict resolution. Are there new places to build coalitions, new kinds of partnerships?
You know, one of the things that I've done in my 3 years, the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, you know, we both were born in Korea. He's a little bit older than I am, but we've become very close, and we speak to each other in Korean, and we've been traveling together, and we've been trying to do just that. So we went to the Great Lakes region in Africa. We went to the Sahel region in Africa. We went to Somalia and the Horn of Africa, three different trips together. And what we tried to do was link his efforts at peace building with our efforts at development. And going together, we think, had a much bigger impact. Usually what it was is we'd step back, wait until all the peace agreements had been settled, and then go in. But we've come to the conclusion that that's too late. So a coalition, even within this multilateral system between the World Bank Group and the UN, has been very powerful. The other thing we've done, though, is that along with the Catholic Church, we've reached out to faith-based groups because we really do believe that this is something we share deeply with the faith-based groups. Every single faith that we know of says that extreme poverty is bad, and it's the responsibility of people of faith to address this problem. So the faith-based groups, and these were Muslims and Hindus and Christians and Jews, many different faiths got together and made a declaration that they were committing themselves to ending extreme poverty. These are all new in the last 3 years.
Has microfinancing and the Muhammad Yunus model for small-scale financing and lending really been a critique of the World Bank's approach, top-down approach to investment and development?
Well, you know, we actually now fund a lot of microenterprise lending. And the key is that everyone in society should have access to capital. Now, you know, one of the things that's changed in 20 years, 20 years ago, John, I was part of a movement called 50 Years is Enough. And we tried to close the World Bank and IMF on their 50th anniversary. And at their 70th anniversary, you know, crazy coincidence, I happened to be president of the World Bank. And part of it's because the World Bank's changed a lot. You know, what Professor Yunus has done is extremely important. His work has been repeated in many other places. And we came to understand from his work that it's that every single person in the world, if they want to start a business, should have access to capital. And John, 95% of all the jobs in the developing world are created in the private sector. So you can't solve the problem of poverty by just creating more government jobs. And in order for those jobs to be created in the private sector, entrepreneurs at every level, whether it's a mother who sells things at the bazaar, and or a small or even a large enterprise, they have such difficulty getting just the initial capital that we've now funded a lot of different efforts to help them get access to capital.
All right, let me see how that works. I mean, I happen to know that two blocks up the street here, there's a Citibank, which is my bank. I know where they are. I have their phone number. If I'm living in extreme poverty in Bangladesh, do I know how to get in touch with the World Bank?
Well, so you may not know how to get in touch with the World Bank, but you've probably benefited from some
of the
projects.
Well, I live in the world. It's the World Bank, right? So, I should be able to call them.
So it's not just a bank where we have tellers and people come and take cash out.
Understood.
We're an investment bank. So let me just tell you exactly how an extremely poor person in Bangladesh. We did a study, and we thought, Well, what's the impact of building roads in Bangladesh? So we actually looked at this and said, knowing that for poor people in Africa especially, but in other parts of the world, poor farmers lose about 50% of their produce because they don't have access to markets. So we asked a question, what if we build roads in Bangladesh that directly connect poor people to markets? Is that going to help? What happened was that we did a study of the groups that did have access to the roads and the groups that did not. And the groups that did have access to the roads, their income went up 75%. And the groups that did not have access to the roads, their incomes went down 25%. So even though that person can't come to a bank teller at the World Bank, that's not how we work, the person in Bangladesh has benefited, especially in those areas where we've built those roads, 20,000 kilometers of the roads, by having access to markets.
But you're still more involved in infrastructure development than you are in direct lending to individual entrepreneurs.
Yeah, the direct lending to individual entrepreneurs happens through intermediaries. So we actually have a private sector group called the International Finance Corporation, and they lend to banks that then can lend to those groups. It would be impossible for us at our scale to be able to handle individual accounts at the few hundred dollar level.
I understand,
but we do try to reach them through the intermediaries. Yeah.
What do you make of the internal difficulties that the World Bank seems to be having right now in terms of political disagreements over the direction that you've decided to take the bank?
Well, when I came into the bank, there had been no real change in the structure for about 20 years. And so every organization needs to rethink its structure. And we had become a little bit too siloed. So I took the bank through a major change that I was convinced that we needed. And most people, before we started the change, were convinced we needed it. But change is really, really hard. The good news is that the change is over. We not only did we change our structure, but we took about $400 million out of the budget, which is always difficult. And no group of employees ever likes that kind of activity. But the good news is we know what we're spending. We know how we're spending. We're much more efficient. And during that time, John, our business went up. So in middle-income countries, 25% increase in business. In our lending to the poorest countries, we had the biggest first year we've ever had. So the demand is there. I think the demand's going to get even greater. We've been through the change. Things are settling down. And now we've really got to look at how are we going to now tackle this problem of ending extreme poverty in just 15 years.
How interconnected are all of these problems, climate change, poverty? You alluded to it before, but in a sense, you have to deal with everything at once. You can't simply saw off Syria and, take a look at a disease over here in Bangladesh. Yeah. You've got to look at everything together.
Yeah. So the way we do it is country by country and then region by region. And what we've now done, and this is part of the change process, is we have our best thinkers in every country say, so what is the task for your particular country in helping to grow your economy, invest in your people, ensuring that they don't fall into poverty? And different countries have different kinds of issues. There are countries in Africa, for example, John, who have huge mineral resources, but their mineral resources have been exploited by a very small group of people, and it hasn't benefited the whole population. It's called the natural resource curse. Other countries need to go from mostly focusing on commodity exports to going up the value chain and doing more value-added kinds of activities. Others need to really focus on their educational system. The key is that it's not the same in any given country, and we now are very intently negotiating with the countries so that we can set priorities.
Jim Yong Kim is president of the World Bank, and if I'm not mistaken, you will be on stage with Beyonce and Big Bird
Big
on
Bird.
Saturday.
Absolutely.
On Saturday. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like Russian, retirement planning, and rock climbing. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI. Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Homelessness is the result of serious gaps between government programs and human needs, serious differences in the housing market in different urban centers, and the basic supply and demand gap that keeps housing costs high at a time when jobs don't pay enough to support rent or a mortgage.
Homelessness follows the economy, and overall homelessness in the U.S. has decreased since the worst times of the 2009 recession. But according to a 2014 report from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, it's on the rise across the country's 50 biggest cities. In Washington, D.C., for instance, the homeless population increased by almost 13%, and that's on par with Los Angeles. Stephen Pimpera is a lecturer in American politics and public policy at the University of New Hampshire. He's the author of A People's History of Poverty in America and says homelessness is actually a collection of a whole range of social problems.
And ultimately, homelessness is a reflection of a particular kind of poverty. And we're here talking about not necessarily absence of money, but absence of housing. When all is said and done, homelessness is a housing problem. And it sort of shows up in two different kinds of ways. One is chronic long-term homelessness. This is often the sort of the visible homelessness, often of, say, men who are living in the street, often with addiction disorders or mental illness. That's maybe about 15% of the overall homeless problem in the United States of America. And then the other 85% is short-term homelessness, more often families with children who may be homeless for a month or 3 months or 6 months. In both of those instances, although there may be rooted in different kinds of longer-term solutions, the problem is lack of access to stable housing, and that for that second group of people, the short-term homeless, it is largely a product of the failure of wages to be high enough for large enough people to pay what going rents are in big cities, which is in part why you see homelessness concentrated in big cities. That's where we're having sort of the most inflation in housing prices.
So when we talk about an emergency in a city like Los Angeles, we're really talking about the gap between wages, living wages, essentially living wages, and the availability of low-cost housing in a big metropolitan area.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's if you look at places like New York and California overall, in order to afford sort of a median two-bedroom apartment, you need to make $25 an hour. Minimum wage, national minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. So you need 3 to 4 times minimum wage in order to buy housing. That's, you know, an enormous problem for larger and larger numbers of people, which is why we do, in fact, see a lack of stable housing tracking to poverty.
So the market isn't going to take care of that. That really requires progressive and forward-thinking urban planning, and you don't necessarily get that in this era, although it varies from city to city, I suspect.
Sure. Although, you know, absolutely, ultimately, the problem is more housing available to larger numbers of people. And in places like San Francisco, especially, this is really acute because geography is getting in the way, among other things. But there are actually sort of programs that solve this. The Section 8 housing voucher program works more or less like food stamps. If you meet certain eligibility requirements, federal government will subsidize your housing, usually tie your rent costs to a third of your income, and then they'll send the difference to your landlord. So it winds up sort of having the government step in and make up for those market failures. The problem is that in most cities, the waiting list is so long to get into that program that they've stopped adding people's name to the list. And that problem was made worse not long ago with the sequestration, right? That ridiculous sort of budget fight that resulted in fairly arbitrary cuts across the board, resulted in the loss of something in the neighborhood of 100,000 of those housing vouchers.
You said a moment ago that 15% of the homeless population is people with addiction problems, mental illness problems. It seems to me there would be a specific program for that 15% that could conceivably alleviate that problem. Is there a way to direct resources to that problem? And how does that work specifically on the street?
For a long while, the sort of the approach for people trying to deal with that kind of homelessness was to deal with what social workers call the co-occurring disorders, the mental illness or the addiction, first in order to get people in a position where they could maintain stable housing. That tended not to work too well. And recently, the consensus, at least among researchers and homeless service providers, is what's often referred to as a housing-first solution. And that is that you get people into housing ultimately absent condition. So they go into housing, they are carrying their addiction with them, and very often are permitted to keep using or to keep drinking. But the theory behind it is that once you get people stably housed, there are greater spaces available to then treat the addiction, to treat the mental illness, to treat the physical illness when they're in place. And the results from those kinds of approaches have been extraordinarily successful.
Finally, in Los Angeles, they declare a state of emergency. What does that even mean? And how would you address a housing emergency other than, you know, calling a news conference?
Well, I mean, it's you know, from what I've read of what's happening in Los Angeles or what's been happening in East Harlem just this week with the announcement of a new police force designed to deal with homelessness in East Harlem, they're not characterizing it as a housing problem. They are characterizing it as a problem of large numbers of people who are visibly homeless in public spaces. And very often, our solution to that is to, in fact, to bring in police forces to identify this as a problem of misuse of public space. And those solutions wind up solving that problem pretty effectively. They wind up pushing those populations to other places so that we are not confronted with their presence on a regular basis. But an approach to homelessness that is thinking of this as a police problem rather than a housing problem is not, in fact, ultimately going to reduce improve the well-being of people or reduce the amount of homelessness.
Stephen Pimper is a lecturer on American politics and public policy at the University of New Hampshire and author of A People's History of Poverty in America. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
How do you say goodbye to someone like Mark Bittman? He's the voice of food in the New York Times and in my kitchen. His dog-eared cookbooks are hanging off my shelves. When I cook, it's like he's there telling me a story about this or that ingredient.
I was at this dinner a year or so ago, and I was discussing a dish with somebody, and she said, "What salt would you use with that?" And I just burst into, I don't know, laughter or tears or anger. And then I was telling that story recently, and someone said, "Well, you know, I don't know why you think that's so outrageous. Of course it matters what salt you use." So that's the kind of change in the food scene that I think we could probably do without, actually.
Bittman has been a commentator for the New York Times for the last 5 years in very interesting times. The profile of food has gone up, but the public's understanding of the consequences of agriculture, he says, has not. Trying to close that gap is what led Bittman to pitch his opinion column to the Times in the first place. And to his surprise, they went for it.
It just seemed to me that everything was affecting food, and food was really, you know, you could compare it to economics or politics. It's there in everything. And there are people who don't realize that. There are people who would argue with it. But there are people who I think have their heads in the sand and still think food is fun. And food is fun. Food is wonderful. We all know that. But it's so much more than that. And it's just, I think, the awareness level of food and political unrest, food and climate change, food and health for sure, food and the environment, resources and so on, has just increased exponentially in the last 5 or 10 years. And I was lucky to have caught that on a kind of leading edge 5 years ago.
What would you say is the most disturbing feature of complacency as far as New York Times readers are concerned, regarding what's really happening in the world of food and what we see when we wander through Whole Foods and see that the world is actually perfect?
Well, you know, New York Times readers are composed of people like you and me and people who are way more powerful than you and me and people who are way less. The people who are way more powerful scare me the most because, to me, the relationship between food, that is agriculture, and climate change is the scariest thing, and there's no attention, almost no attention paid to it. And I'm not talking about the impact of climate change on agriculture. I'm talking about the impact of agriculture on climate change. And that we've known about this for 10 years or more, and there have been almost no changes in the world of food and agriculture to mitigate its impact on climate change.
Are these things like methane production in livestock? What are you talking about?
Well, we're talking about transportation of food because so much of the food in the United States and elsewhere travels so far. So there's that transportation carbon footprint thing. We're talking about methane production. Yes, we're talking about the fact that some methods of farming sequester carbon much, much better than other methods of farming. We're talking about what it takes to feed cattle and other livestock. We're talking about a whole host of things that could be addressed, and each of which could make significant contributions to reducing greenhouse gases.
But that's not reflected in people's food choices, even though it might be a political discussion.
You've hit the nail on the head. There are both personal choices and there's a political discussion. So on a personal level, I and many others argue that the more plants we eat, the smaller our carbon footprint, the better off we all are. And obviously from a health perspective, that's true too. But on a political level, it continues to kind of baffle me that 98% of attention is paid to fossil fuel reduction. And, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that, but the balance is off. We're not looking at agriculture. I think that just speaks to the power of the agriculture lobby. What
have you managed to sound the signal on, do you think, effectively?
It's hard for me to speak about the impact because I was in this moment. I was of this moment. I don't feel like I caused it or led it in any way. But the one thing that I think I was early on was the relationship or the role of food workers in food, which is a sort of an obvious thing to say. But 5 years ago, and certainly a little bit longer ago, people who considered themselves foodies or whatever term you want to use cared more about the welfare of animals than they did about the welfare of human beings in the food system. And that has changed and is changing. Again, nothing wrong with talking about and considering animal welfare, but when the people who bring us food, who are arguably among the most important workers in the country, cannot afford to buy the food that they're producing, there's something wrong with that. And I think more and more people are recognizing that. The fight for 15, the fight for a minimum wage that's almost twice what the national minimum wage is now, was really led by and has been led by food workers, and to some extent, no small extent, with the support of people who would call themselves foodies. And I think I did have some impact on that. But in any case, it's a good development.
What is it about corporate startups that attracts you, aside from, you know, the obvious?
I mean, I wrote about what I like to call fast food 2.0 or whatever a few years ago. And around that time, I said, I'm interested in doing a fast food business. And I pitched stuff and I went to venture capitalists and had conversations. And I think in a way, the problem was that I was not focused enough, that I was way too into the opinion column and the other journalism that I was doing to really say, okay, I'm dropping all of this and I'm all in on whatever idea I had. But this was an idea that came to me, and it's a really good idea. And I thought, this is the right time to make this kind of change. It's not that I feel done with journalism by any means, but I've always been a person who's changed what I'm doing, and I like new things. And I just didn't see what was next that was going to be as exciting as what I'd done in journalism. And this thing, which I've been involved in for now, I don't know, since mid-May, is all-encompassing, and it's the kind of excitement that I want. So whether it's a success or a failure, it's been already been 4 months of super fun. And I think when it becomes more public and when we launch, I think it's just going to be totally amazing.
Is there any place in the world that the cuisine interests you more now than when you started this gig?
Yeah, the United States.
Really?
I don't say that lightly. It's something I've thought about a lot. I find myself traveling internally, domestically, much, much more and not being frustrated by it. Domestically, we are doing amazing things. There's no limit to the energy and passion of people who are cooking and who are involved in food right now in the United States, and other places seem pokey by comparison. It's all right here. I mean, it goes back to where we started this conversation. It's all right here, but our agricultural scene, the lack of planning, the lack of thought, the lack of a discussion of the right of people to eat affordably and healthily and in a way that's environmentally sound, all of that I really think is a tragedy. But The flip side of that coin is that there's enormous energy being put into creating great food in the U.S. right now, and it's a fun, interesting time.
Until this month, Mark Bittman was an op-ed columnist at the New York Times and the Times Magazine's food columnist. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. TIAA Cref, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to RockFound.org.